when you dare to take a breath. Don't care about no medals on your chest. Your steely-eyed killer shadow in the night. You were born to fight. You gotta light 'em up.
Welcome to Straight Outta Combat Radio, audio medicine from Green Zone Hero. We're proudly American, unapologetically patriotic, and politically incorrect. We are the voice, the platform for transitioning veterans, honoring their stories and wisdom.
Save us all before they burn it down.
Welcome to Straight Outta Combat Radio. I'm John Krotek, Army veteran.
And I'm Chris Hager, Gold Star father.
Our guest today is Marine veteran Ryan Persaud. He is a New York City native, 5 years United States Marine Corps. He has two combat deployments, one in 2012 in Afghanistan, where he served as an air support liaison, actually was on the team for British forces in Helmand Province. There he received the Air Support Operator Navy Achievement Medal for heroism, and I'm sure we'll hear about that. And second deployment was in 2014. He was involved in Air Support Operator and Counterintelligence during Operation Inherent Resolve, and we're very pleased to have you here with us this morning, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
It's an honor. Always love it. Normally, we have difficulty with Marines because cell phones are mechanical devices. Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't go there.
Just teasing.
Just messing with you, man. So.
I can say that my son, Army Ranger and Ranger instructor, and it was always fun to give Marines a hard time that so many of them couldn't pass the PT to start Ranger school because it was push-ups instead of pull-ups.
I have heard that.
Yeah, we do. Well, we don't do any push-ups for our physical training stuff. So, yeah, it's pull-ups. So, yeah, I could see how that would. And, you know, some of us are meatheads, so it's kind of hard to do a push-up. Giant muscles, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, let's get started, Ryan. Let's tell us about growing up in New York City. Tell us about that.
So I grew up in a place called Poughkeepsie. It's about 30, 45 minutes away from New York City itself. It was okay for the most part. We got hit pretty hard with the housing crisis that happened, and I forget what year it was. We went from being a thriving area to kind of a low-income area, and that kind of changed the dynamics. When I was getting a little bit older, things started to get a little bit rougher. Looking back, I think that, like a lot of people's families and whatnot, were financially hurting. I know mine was, so that put a lot of strain on things, and it's funny how it can change the dynamics of an area like that.
So what kind of things did you do there? I mean, did you have a family background in the military, or, you know, what got you interested in that?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. My grandfather, he worked for the Royal Marines doing some sort of shipping during a long, long time ago, the British Marines. And then my father, who was actually born in Guyana, South America, ended up coming to the U.S. He joined the Marines to get his citizenship, actually. So, yeah, he had served in the Marines, and then he got out, and he was a police officer. And ever since I was a kid, I was kind of, like, infatuated with the Marines. You would take me to, like, the recruiting station, get stickers, and I'd put them in my room and stuff like that. So it was one of those things where there was no question in anyone's mind that I was going to join the Marines. I actually didn't even take the SATs or anything like that, because 2 weeks after graduating high school, I went straight to boot camp.
I love it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So tell us about boot camp.
Boot camp was fun. I think growing up in the city, or in a city-like environment, gives you a little bit of a different experience in boot camp, because the screaming, the yelling, all that stuff really didn't have too much of an effect on me. But there were some, I guess you call them, like country guys who were from
polite families.
Probably never been yelled at. And I saw some people freak out there. But the whole time I was there, I mean, a lot of stuff I laughed. But I did have my dad, you know, having a dad that went through, he told me all about what to expect. I mean, he went through in like the 80s, so it's a little bit different back then. But, you know, same gist of the thing of what you'd expect there. Just a lot of yelling, some mind games. I was always getting in trouble for, like, laughing at things, though. That was my problem.
So you did a lot more pull-ups than everybody else, or did everybody?
Yeah.
Or they made everybody do it.
I think I lost like 30, 40 pounds at boot camp or something like that. So a lot of that was probably they stick you up on the quarter deck when you screw up, and they did this thing called IT, intensive training, I think it stands for, where you're doing push-ups, burpees. I mean, it's nonstop. They're going to wear you out.
That's kind of funny, though, man. You're the first Marine that's gone to, you know, Paris Island that told me they had fun.
I loved it. Yeah. I thrive in chaos. That's kind of like been my thing. Utter chaos there. So I remember one time we were on the third deck of the barracks that we were living. So we were running up and down, doing all this stuff. And after a while, I mean, I just found it comical because we were doing the same. I mean, it was like, go upstairs, come down to, and I remember looking over at my friend and laughing. And right when I laughed, one of the drill instructors like opened up the door to the second deck and just snatched me up and dragged me in there. And yeah, I got in trouble for that. But I mean, it's definitely not for everyone. It was definitely hard.
What was graduation like? Did your dad come down?
Yeah. So my parents had actually got divorced when I was younger, but it was cool because everybody came and watched me graduate and all that. And they all kind of came back together as a family for, you know, the few hours that we were there. So it was a double reward. I got to become a Marine and I got my, you know, some time with my family together there.
You know, I haven't been to a graduation, but Chris and I have heard that the Marine Corps graduations are something really a sight to be seen.
Oh, it is. I'm pretty sure if you YouTube it, you can see some of this stuff. You know, there's some marching and, you know, we're drilling out there, so they're perfecting it. So it's definitely something you want to watch.
I saw my oldest graduate from boot as an Army. Saw him get out of jump school, saw him get his Ranger tab, and saw my other son at Coast Guard graduation too. So, and they really are. All of the services, it is a transitional moment in so many lives. They do a great job. It is just a well-done event.
So the whole thing's just a proud moment, you know. And one thing that's good about the Marines is we know how to do a parade or a party. That's definitely our...
You're giving us a lot of good intel here, man. I mean, we're picking up on a lot of good things here about the Marines. So I know, you know, we know that all Marines are riflemen, but what was your specialty? You were in communications?
So it's complicated. The way to think about it, I guess the one great way to explain it is kind of like a 911 operator, right? The gist of what our job was is, say, a team or a platoon or whatever's out there and they get into a firefight and they need air support. They'll call in to their, like a JTAC, Joint Terminal Air Controller, and he'll basically come to us and request an aircraft, be it fixed wing, or a helicopter or something like that. And we kind of like manage all the aircraft that we have, and we can scramble aircraft or divert aircraft or send aircraft to a certain area. And the same thing, we can do that same exact thing with artillery. So it's basically like, hey, we're having a 911 moment. They call us and we get, you know, the aircraft or, in terms of the analogy here, the police, the fire, whoever they need out there for them. But the job's kind of versatile as well, especially with the changing of technology here. We have things like air support liaison teams, which is what I was on, where they can take four guys and stick them out with a unit just to ease the communications. Because, you know, comms always going to fail no matter what you do. They'll stick us with maybe like a division headquarters, something like that, and we'll get the requests and then pass it on to our guys and in the back, kind of like a chain reaction type thing.
What's the best badass air support you can send in?
For me, it'd be the A-10s.
Warthogs.
Yeah, you send in Warthogs, and those guys, they love to blow things up. But also, one of my favorites from Afghanistan is the AH-64, the Apache, because those guys will blow some stuff up.
That's cool.
That is it. I remember, you know, of course, I was a peacetime guy, but I remember the A-10s, you know, out at Fort Irwin in California at the National Training Center, just listening to that gun on the front of that, the nose of that aircraft is just phenomenal to hear that.
Yeah, the burr noise that comes out of it.
Yeah, I mean, just that, yeah. That alone freaks you out, you know, let alone the platform that thing's on.
Now, Marie, you didn't have 130s on your, did you? You couldn't call in a 130.
You mean C-130 aircraft?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we went on those, especially like...
No, I mean, when they're loaded up, what are they, Jolly Green, what do they call the...
The Spectres?
Yeah, the Spectres, the gunship.
Oh, you're talking about the AC-130, the gunship?
Yeah.
With the howitzer on it?
The AC-130, yeah. Yeah, we had one of those in Afghanistan twice, built, I think was the call sign, and I saw them fly around. Those guys do some damage. That's for heavy hitter stuff, though, you know? That's a lot of times like the SF guys, Special Forces guys, are going to get that stuff from what I've seen.
What was it like working with the British in Helmand Province? What was that like?
So for me, I loved it because I actually was a dual citizen prior to joining the Marines. My dad was born in Guyana, but prior to coming to the U.S., my grandmother's actually from Northern Ireland, Belfast. So my dad lived there. That's where my grandfather met my grandmother. I had been to England multiple times. I have family there and all that. So when I went over there, it was just, I was right at home with those guys. I mean, I have the unit I was with, 26th Royal Artillery, they actually gave me their unit flag for helping them out.
That's really cool.
That's great.
Happened out there.
So what was going on with in Afghanistan? So you were basically fire support, air support operator.
Yeah, so I went out to a tiny place in Lashkar Gah, Afghanistan, a small little base. It was a compound that they'd kind of like taken over and spruced up. And I went over there and I just kind of did the air support for the British, Estonian, and there were some other troops out there too. Because Afghanistan's, you know, very diverse. There's a lot of different countries out there. So where we were at was actually like a kind of like a little international hub, because there was the British, the Danish, Estonians, Canadians had come there. I was one of only four Americans there though, so very culturally diverse as well. And interesting, because it was a good learning experience too. You get to learn from other cultures, and you know, you get to learn about how other militaries do things, and there was a lot of trading of uniforms and different gear like that. So the whole thing was just fun. I mean, I would go back tomorrow if I could.
Who had better food?
The Brits have the best food in the world. What they do is they like import.
What they have, bangers, man? Like, what do they have out there?
So they would import these, what do you want to call them? Like Sri Lankans and Nepalese people.
Sure.
And they would come literally cook for you at the base. So, you know, we have MREs, which are terrible. The British MREs are like gourmet meals, and you can actually like cook them. So the Sri Lankans would like take the meal rations and cook them up and everything like that. And you'd have like black pudding sausage, eggs. You could get eggs however you wanted. And this is in the middle of like nowhere too. So how we even managed to get this great food was amazing. And the funny thing is we were just on a small little base there. So whenever we did get attacked or anything like that, you would see like the people that were working for food did not appreciate that. We had a few people from the local village there too, like our barber. We got a barber to come in. He was just an Afghani guy who lived out there. So we used a lot of the people in the area, because Lashkar Gah is actually a city. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are good people. Supposedly that area was built during the, I forget who it was, like FDR, when they were trying to beef up the economy there, when they sent people out to do things. Apparently the Americans built like their city over there. So it's actually shaped and centered like an American city.
So the people in that area were generally pretty friendly, even though that province was a hotbed.
Yeah, the area was actually really bad. The people there were really cool. There was a lot of kids and stuff. Whenever you did guard duty, the kids would come out and talk to you, and they wanted to ask you, oh, are you American? Are you British? You know, and they would come talk. And even other people, they would walk past you there and wave at you. It was nice, but I was there when the whole issue with the Quran burning happened. And then that issue where our scout snipers and the dead bodies, and there's something else that happened. So once that happened, the whole area kind of changed a little bit. You'd see less people. We started to get attacked more, and the kids started to like throw rocks at you. Everything kind of changed after that.
What year was that? When was that? 2012?
2012. Yeah, I'll tell you exactly when. It's February of like 2012, the dynamics of that area shifted. The fighting all over Afghanistan actually picked up as well. I don't know if there's a direct cause of those incidents, or because there's a in Afghanistan there's seasons. There's the fighting season. When it gets warm and the weather starts to get, you know, better over there, everybody comes out to fight. And then come the wintertime, it actually gets pretty cold and it rains and it's sometimes overcast. And I guess they don't fight during that. They don't like to come out and fight during that period.
So was it warlords? What was it? I mean, how does it operate over there, and the people in general? Is it controlled by specific families, or how's it set up?
So the thing about Afghanistan is it's a lot different from Iraq. In Afghanistan, it's very tribal. So Iraq, you have like Sunni Shia conflicts, but in Afghanistan, every village has a tribe and a village elder and all that, and they might fight with each other, they might be friends with each other, but they're not secular, I guess you would call it. I mean, they're Muslims, but they're not. There's not much secular violence. The way it was explained to me, and I saw in a documentary about Afghanistan, an Afghan guy actually said this. He said whoever comes here with the guns, they're the ones who are in charge. So if the Taliban comes into the village and they have guns, you're in charge. If the Americans or British come into our village and they hang around and they have guns, you guys are in charge now. You know, those people are really just trying to live their life and farm and do what they got to do. It was a lot easier than Iraq, because in Iraq, you have different factions fighting. They had a military. It was, you know, more city-like populated. So Afghanistan's a lot different than Iraq. It was a little bit of a, I guess the hearts and minds thing's a lot easier in Afghanistan than it is Iraq, because in Iraq, you'd have to change the whole country's heart and mind, whereas in Afghanistan, you know, each village you go to, you can work on village to village.
So you were in Iraq in 2014.
I was actually in Kuwait and in some other places I can't speak about for the counterintelligence stuff. When I was in Kuwait, I was doing a lot of monitoring of the UAV strikes or UAS strikes in Iraq and Syria over there.
Tell us about your medal for heroism, if you'd want to.
Right, so this was in Afghanistan. I had to go to the operations center because we had this big thing that was going on, because a little bit up north near the area of Sangin, the Taliban had driven by this base and thrown grenades over their, like, wall, and it landed in the tent of some guys that were sleeping, and it killed five of them. And then it became, like, an everyday thing where these guys were just getting into... So there's different levels of we're getting shot at. There's the moderate level, like, hey, we got some pop shots, and we can't see where they're at, we need some air support. Or, like, hey, you know, there's, like, 12 guys, and we're having a firefight. And then there's what they call a TIC, troops in contact, which is like the most severe 911 call, I guess you could say. And this is, we're pinned down and I can't even pick my head up because we're surrounded. So that area, we were getting TICs 3 to 4 times a day from different people all over the area. So we had to really ramp up operations out there. And we had, like, the special operations guys come down and start hanging outside of our operations center because they were working a lot out there. So long story short, I'm in the operations center. Actually, the night prior, there had been an issue where a British light armored vehicle hit an IED and it flipped over and they couldn't get the guys out. They were literally burning to death inside of this thing. We didn't know. There was really, like, not much we could do. They were getting shot at as well. So I put some aircraft out there. And then it came to the point where the guys had passed away, but they couldn't open up the doors to the vehicle. So we needed to, I mean, we scrambled everybody. We had the Air Force PJs go in, the quick reaction force from Camp Leatherneck. Everybody went in, but it was just too late. So I basically had come up with this plan the night prior to have 24 hours continuous air support and overwatch and dealing with the logistics. And it went up to the general out there, and he approved the plan. So I went in because was kind of getting commended as well for what I'd done the night prior. And this kind of contributed to the medal that I got as well. So about an hour after that, I'm just walking back to my tent and I see people running and I'm like, that's kind of weird. And then I see this other Marine, which is like, you never see them there, with this guy over his shoulder, and he's just running into our medical center. And there's people screaming, run, run, run. And I'm kind of in shock because I'm like, what is going on right now? And I look over and there's this Marine Corps Major, Major Casey. He's just calmly walking and, like, putting on a glove, and he had his rifle. So I just went to him naturally and I said, hey, sir, what's going on? He said, you know, my staff sergeant just told me that there's some people shooting up here. So I was like, okay, so we just got to go. I mean, it was weird. There's people from other countries' militaries. They actually didn't have their weapons on them running past us, and we're just running forward with our guns up. And what had happened was, the Afghan National Army had come to our base and asked for water or food, something like that. And I guess one of the guys at the gate, the British kids, told them, no, you can't come in here. You can go next door. There's an Afghan National Police compound. Maybe they'll help you out. Well, within that group of ANA soldiers was I don't know what the word is for them, but he was actually a Taliban sympathizer inside of the Afghan National Army. So when we said no, he kicked the door in and shot the two gate guards in the face with the PKM, which is like an AK-47 with a drum round on it, and ran right past the guy with the machine gun there and straight into us. And one of the guys in front of me just took him out. I mean, there's bullets coming towards us. And then some other guys with beards, God knows who they were, came out, and we had went in and kicked the door into this compound over next door and cleared it, grabbed the guy out. the QRF went out, there was an IED inside of a vehicle right outside the base. So there's a whole planned attack on our base. For the whole incident, the reason why I got the medal was because me and this major secured the entire base pretty much by ourselves. And you said earlier, every Marine's a rifleman, and it actually says that within my medal, because that wasn't the plan going over there. You know, we actually weren't supposed to be getting shot at or anything like that. Yeah, this incident kicked off, and I got the Navy Achievement Medal for my actions that day.
Congratulations on that. You know, it's definitely something to be proud of, and I'm glad you were able to tell us that story.
It was an interesting situation there. Afterwards, there was kind of a battle within my command. It's strange because people were saying that I was under-awarded and that they should have written me for something higher. Then they were thinking about putting a V on it for Valor. It was kind of political. I was a very young guy. I was 19 years old when that happened. I think I just became a Lance Corporal. So there was a little bit of, I don't know if we should give this guy too much because he's young and we don't want to get to his head. But, you know, I was a little bit bitter about that for a while. And I think it's, you know, you do this stuff and you're in a situation where you feel like you're going to get killed or something like that. And you're just running out there and you feel like, you know, I had people in my head telling me you should have something more, and then people saying you got what you got. So, you know, I was young and impressionable, and I was a little bit angry for a little bit for feeling like I should have got more. But at the end of the day, there were people who lost their lives in that incident and did have a profound effect on me. I think just being young and seeing people dead and then thinking, oh, I could be next, but you're just doing what you got to do, can definitely mess with your head a little bit as far as being that young.
Yeah. What was it like, your support back home? Did you talk to your family a lot? Or
I actually didn't get to talk to my family much. We had means to contact them, obviously, but we were a little bit remote. So you could use the internet. I think you had 30 minutes of internet usage a day. We had a satellite phone that our lieutenant hogged, and we didn't even know halfway through. So thanks a lot to that guy. We finally got that, and we were able to make some phone calls. What happens in Afghanistan is anytime someone gets killed, they shut off all communication in order to prevent people from, like, imagine if you lost your loved one in combat and then, like, their friend called you from there and gave you the details before the military did. So we try to cut down on that.
Right.
So they do this, and the British do this thing called op minimize, where if anyone gets seriously injured or killed in combat, they shut off all communication so no one can go back home. So towards the fighting season, unfortunately, that started to happen a lot. A lot of guys are stepping on IEDs or getting shot. So that really cut down the way that you could contact home for us as well. But totally understandable as to why they do that. There was an incident, a story I heard where, and how I guess it came about, and I think it was in like early Iraq, a British soldier was killed, and one of his teammates or friends had told his wife. And then that guy's wife, I guess, called the wife of the guy that had been killed and was telling her stuff that maybe necessarily wasn't true, because you're talking, you know, in the game of telephone where one thing becomes one thing. And there was this huge, I mean, she didn't know what was going on. And then it took the British military a while to get to her. And so they cut down on that, essentially. The Americans do it as well.
I've lived through it, Ryan. I got the first time I got a call was at a job site. Some people had been wounded, and he got his cell phone out when he shouldn't have. They tried to shut it down. And so all of the wives were out of Fort Carson and Colorado Springs, 1-9. Everybody knew somebody had been killed and been shot, but they didn't know who it was. And the assumption was it was my son. And of course, and he wasn't. So it, you know, that 12 hours was tough. Then when it finally did happen, I'm in a truck at a stoplight and got a cell phone call, and it was, we've lost him, he's gone. I can't talk now. That's not how you want to be told your son's.
I can't imagine that.
Your son's been killed.
No, it's not. My sympathies go out to you. I was just with Scott Bill, you know, Brian Bill Foundation.
Yeah, no, Scott Will.
And yeah, and told his story too, and it's just something that I can't. No, I honestly think it's great that you guys do stuff like this. Because, you know, I've seen people who their families, the devastation that it does. Some people just don't know what to do. But to come out and do stuff for veterans and do stuff like this, really, I'm sure it helps with the healing process as well. But yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine, and I feel so bad for that.
The relationship I've had been able to build with soldiers that had served with my son are priceless to me, and yeah. It is to their honor and to your honor. It never gets better. It does get different, and sometimes we get a chance to make a big difference.
Yeah, and that's great that you can come out and do something like that. You know, I don't know how I would handle that, but it makes me think too, like, when you're over there and you're serving, you know, you're doing what you want, you know, you're doing your day-to-day thing, you know, and I guess you don't really think about the effect that it has on your family if anything had happened to you or something like that, you know, because you're dedicated to your service, you know, and when I think now, I think, wow, you know, like, I can only imagine how you feel as a parent knowing that your son or daughter is overseas.
One of the things that Chris and I talk about a lot is, you know, that young men and women in uniform, and even myself personally, you know, we enlisted or joined the armed services because we love our countries. And
yeah,
we don't join the military because we hate people and we want to kill. We do it because of the exact opposite. We do it because we love this country. We understand the high price that the people paid for us to enjoy these things back home. And yeah. I know that, you know, sitting next to a Gold Star father, and, you know, I've heard Chris's story about Josh, and every time we hear stories like yours, it solidifies the reasons why we do this even more. And, you know, you talk about the politics of awards, you know, I can relate to that. I've seen it, know about it. And by listening to guys like you and listening to the stories and hearing your insights and wisdom, that we're able to not forget the reasons why we do the things we do to protect this great country.
Yeah, I mean, I coming from New York too, having witnessed 9/11 really put that was the icing there on the cake for joining the military, because those planes flew over my house where I'd lived. And I mean, we knew people that worked in the World Trade Center and whatnot. I had seen it and whatnot. So you see that, and I think for some people like myself, you take it personally. You know, it's like, wow, you just attacked my country. That's the call to arms there. You know, you just feel patriotic after that. And you know, we were kicked. Iraq and Afghanistan was going on when I joined. And something one of my gunnery sergeants told me is a lot of us who were older joined when there wasn't a conflict going on. But you guys, you joined when there was two wars going on. You know, so that he said that says something about you guys.
That's
when you join to go to war, you know, you're going to war. So, you know, you're signing that paper saying, hey, I want to go right over there. And to me, that's really what it was. I said, you know, I watched these guys attack my country and kill my fellow countrymen and women, and I'm going over there.
Well, that's, you know, that's what a great tribute. And, you know, and the thing is that less than 1% of the population actually served. So consider yourself in an elite group of young men and women who understand the cause and the high price of freedom. Kudos
yeah.
to you.
The hardest part about my time in the military was getting out, actually, being out now. Sometimes I still...
Tell us about
even when
that.
I do
Tell
things
us
like
about
this,
that. Yeah.
You know. Well, so I was in Kuwait. I had submitted a re-enlistment package to go on this second deployment. My time was kind of running out here. At the time, it was, I think they called it sequestration, where they're trying to downsize the military.
Yep.
So I put my reenlistment package in, and they're like, all right, cool, you can go. So I go, and I'm maybe like 3-4 months in this deployment, or I think about 5 months actually into this deployment. And my gunny goes, hey, you can't reenlist, man. There's no openings or anything like that for you guys right now, the time period you came in. And so I'm over there like, wait, what? And they're like, you got 3 months to get out. So I was like, oh, crap. So I come home early. I basically came home, turned my gear in, applied for school. I already had an apartment, and I was good. So, and then I just was out one day. I swear to God, I put my uniform on one day, and then the next day, I was sitting on the couch. I'd sit on the couch, my sleeves rolled and my boots out and everything, for maybe like 3 months after I got out, because I just didn't even know what to do. I used to go back onto the Marine Corps base, Camp Pendleton,
yeah,
to go get coffee or go to my unit and say hi to people, just because I was kind of like, am I out? Like, I couldn't believe it. I get worked up talking about this more or less than the combat stuff, too, because I, you know, I really love the Marines, and I had no intentions on getting out anytime soon. I mean, if I could have stayed in for, my friends used to call me a lifer, like I was sitting there for the rest of my life, I would have. You know, but unfortunately, the way things happened, that didn't happen. But you know what? looking back now, I guess I'm one of those people that thinks everything happens for a reason. So
you're right about
that. You know, that was just my time, you know?
Yeah, you're right about that. And, you know, the transition, you know, it sounds like you weren't even really debriefed on what to expect.
No, I had actually done what they call TRS, Transition Readiness Seminar, stuff you do before you get out, where they're kind of like, give you a heads up, like, hey, you're getting ready to go into the real world, so you got to figure out what you want to do with your life. I'd gone to that before I went on my deployment. Most people go 3 months before they get out. So I went on that, and I really didn't pay attention to it because I was planning on putting my reenlisted package in. It was kind of just to say, in case anything happens, do this, so if you had to get out. But I wasn't expecting that. So we're talking like maybe a year goes by. So I forgot about all this stuff that I had learned about applying for school and whatnot. So I really relied heavily on my friends and some guys I knew who got out. So I was like, y'all need to help me out because I'm getting out.
I understand, and I'm familiar with the price that our military has paid for sequestration and the battle right now that's going on in the next couple of weeks to try and solve that problem. But to hear somebody whose life was changed, it disgusts me. I am so disappointed for so many reasons in the lack of political will that so many in our government have shown over the years. Thank God we've got a change in attitude of those kinds of things.
I mean, I was totally, I mean, my life was kind of screwed up from that, you know, just having to get out and then figure out, I didn't even know what I wanted to do. They were like, all right, time to apply for school. I was like, well, I don't even know what I want to study.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Here you are, a trained, qualified, willing asset that our country needs, and morons in Washington have made it so you are thrown out. It's just...
Yeah,
I nonsensical is an understatement.
I'm trying to be kind with words, and it's very difficult, you know. And my son had long talk with his wife before he deployed, and said, "When I get back, that I'm going special forces." He had been a Ranger instructor for 2.5 years, so he was. Mm-hmm. They wanted him, and he was committed. I mean, we can't afford to lose those kinds of people. We just need you. It's the tip of the spear.
And then they'll lose them in the mix when they get back here.
Yeah,
all that makes things worse. I mean, that makes the transition, which is already hard enough, even harder when you weren't expecting to get out and all that. And that honestly contributed to why I went through a pretty dark phase for about a year and a half. I actually had to like check myself into the emergency mental health clinic at the VA down there in San Diego after a while, after like 6-7 months of being out, because I just couldn't handle it. I had gotten a job and everything, and I was going to school, and I said, all right, let me just occupy my time. So I was working as an investigator for this attorney's office, and then I was going to school on the Marine Corps base at night, and I burned myself out doing that. I mean, we're talking like 15-hour days there. Yeah. And I'm doing something I didn't even like. You know, I really didn't even like it. And then the whole time I'm trying to cope with the fact that I just got out. Then not only that, but one thing I think contributed to PTSD is in the military, you don't have time to really like sit around and dwell on things that happened. You're going. And then when I got out, I was talking to another one of my friends, and he said that this happened. This is a common thing with veterans, right? So you get out. And then you may have not even noticed that you may have PTSD or anything like that inside the service because of the way that we operate. You know, I guess you don't realize it. And then you get out and you're doing your thing and you're kind of trying to become a person, you know, I guess literally trying to become a person again.
Right.
And then these things creep up on you. You know, you start sitting there and then the coulda, shoulda, woulda starts to happen. And then the dreams start to happen. And then all this other stuff starts to happen. And then it got to the point. My mom would call me every day saying, I'm worried about you. And I'm living in San Diego, bear in mind, not even anywhere near my family. They live here in Florida. So I'm out there by myself. My friends start either getting out and going home or going to different duty stations because they were able to stay in. And next thing I know, I'm totally alone out there. I have no support group whatsoever. And then the VA, they're a whole other beast. I got out and I instantly said, I'm probably going to need some mental health, whatever. So I had a, went over there, got the referral, and I went to go get an appointment. And it took me 6 months from the time that I got out, 6 months to get an appointment with a VA medical or a mental health professional. I didn't even make it 6 months. Like 5 months in, I had to go to the emergency mental health clinic because I couldn't leave my bed. I was having this thing where I felt like everything was spinning. I had to quit my job because of that. It was my anxiety, my depression, everything just became, it was unbearable. And I say that coming from someone who did the stuff that I did while I was in the Marines, to give you an idea of how severe it was enough to make it to where I couldn't get out of my bed or do anything.
Well, you know,
at all.
Couple of interesting points. First of all, we're glad that you are here today, you know, telling us the story. And second of all, you know, you raise a very good point that Chris and I have talked a lot about, you know, people that have been through trauma, ourselves included, that it's not being weak to reach out. And, you know, it sucks that it took 5 months. That's ridiculous. But The fact that you had the cojones to actually reach out for help speaks volumes. And, you know, that's such a powerful message to others that might be going through something similar. It's not weakness to reach out. And I'll tell you right now, Chris and I are glad that you did.
Yeah, I'm glad I did too, because my quality of life is the reason I came down here to Florida was to I ended up having to pay out of pocket for a therapist out there. And she just changed my life dramatically. And then I finally, I was making complaints to the VA, like, hey, I'm paying out of pocket for this stuff. So then they finally got on board and they started paying for that. And then I started to take an antidepressant and an anti-anxiety, which really helped me out. And then I had quit that job, which helped, but I started to go back to school. And I was actually like going on campus Monday through Friday, and I was meeting people. They were a little bit young. It's hard when you go to school when you're 23, because you're in school with a bunch of 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that makes things complicated. But I had a teacher that was a veteran, another teacher that was a retired DEA head in the Miami office, and then my other teacher was a parole officer, because I went to school for criminal justice. They essentially became my support group there, because I could sit after class and talk to them about stuff. And not all of them were in the military, but they were in law enforcement. There was a similar bond that we had there, you know, and they like to look out for the veteran guys as well. But something that did make it a little bit hard was the trying to meet people who are 18, 19, 20, even people who are my age, because they just the life experience is really different. I actually have that problem now, still at 25. You're trying to meet people and you just realize, oh, geez, we have nothing in common.
No. Yeah. Well, and you talk about what Gold Star families, your understanding, appreciation of what we go through. In 2010, I was just looking on the internet, and I do that occasionally. It's not compulsive, but I do it constantly. No. But the story I read was about one of the young men that had served with my son who had committed suicide, and he did not get the treatment he needed. He got drugs, and the drugs were wrong. But this article had a copy of his suicide note, and his suicide note said what he couldn't bear to live with was having seen my son die. So 4 years after Josh had died, I'm seeing a soldier who commits suicide because my son had died.
Another casualty.
The casualties and the heart, the thing that just infuriates me, he was a casualty of war, and our military does not want to acknowledge that. And that is a crime. That is disrespects his efforts, his service. It disrespects his family. That young man was a casualty of war. I don't care how the final end came.
Yeah.
And that's...
That unfortunately happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my friends, Josh McCaleb, he got out after like 11 years, and he actually drank himself to death. But he had some issues while he was in still. He went in like early Iraq, and he had done a different job than us. He had transferred over to our job, and he was having a hard time while he was in. And to be honest with you, the thing that pissed me off the most was that while he was in, he was trying to get help. And you could tell this guy needed help. I mean, he was an alcoholic. He needed help. This guy really needed help. And no one would help him. They would punish him.
Yeah.
He would get in trouble for drinking or get in trouble for this, that, lose his rank, you know. And then the guy gets out, and 2 months later, he's dead. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, you know, we could have stopped this. And I had another kid named Jamal Gillard. He killed himself. I was his corporal. He was showing all the signs that something wasn't right. He got a speeding ticket. He was doing like 130. And I remember sitting down talking like, what's going on here, man? Like, why would you do 130? That's not just regular speeding. And then he would do other things, and he started to get in trouble more. And I remember saying to someone, hey, there's more to this, because this kid was never like this. What is why is he getting into trouble. Like, well, do we need to be punishing him, or is it, it's kind of like the criminal justice system today. You think, do we need to punish this person, or do we need to rehabilitate this person? And you know what? They ended up just kicking him out. And then not even a week later, he killed himself.
Oh.
But he didn't leave a note. He didn't leave anything. He just did it. And I remember when I heard about it, I said, I knew that this was going to happen. And I remember saying something, and I sent my CO an email about it afterwards, saying, like, we knew this was going to happen, but we just sat there and we punished these people. And then, you know, you think about the VA, does the same thing almost. They're not directly punishing you, but when you got to wait 6 months to get an appointment, I mean, these are people who are already making a step to reach out and get help.
Absolutely.
And then you can't even get the help you need.
Yeah.
And it's not like everyone gets out and they got money to go pay for a, I mean, I had disability, so I had money to pay for my own therapist and all that. Other people can't do that. You know, I was fortunate enough to have that. And then you have these situations happen. So it happens in the military, and it happens with the VA and all that too. You know, I'm actually considering getting private health insurance, just paying for it, because I can't wait 6-7 months for an appointment. I can't wait for my medication to run out and then for me to have to wait for it to come in the mail for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, that's why these things happen with people.
And it's why we talk about them, because, you know, people need to know these things. What mm-hmm. You know, what do you want the non-civilian population to know about combat veterans? Is there any wisdom you can give us, Ryan?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, there's a little bit of a stigma behind combat veterans. Not everybody who goes through combat is a different person. I know this from when I was applying to different police departments when I got out. I thought, oh, they're just going to take me because I'm a Marine combat veteran. Well, turns out people look at you kind of like you're a liability. You know, and that's not really the case. You can go through trauma and or combat and come back and get, sort your life out and not be a different person like people think. If anything, going through all of those experiences in my life and coming out has really humbled me, and I think it matured me. And I think that I'm light years ahead of my peers as far as emotionally, intellectually, and maturity. Really, there's a stigma behind going to combat, and that's not the case, you know. And if you did go through combat, you can always, and there are things that are bothering you, there's things you can do. You know, it's sometimes I think the big thing is you feel like nothing's fun anymore, because nothing's as fun as going to deploy and do all that stuff and the camaraderie you have in the military. You're not going to find that really when you get out.
But no, you're not.
Something I just recently found out is don't go searching for that. But I'd say the biggest takeaway I have for combat veterans here is I just recently, when I went with on the Brian Bill Foundation, there was a MARSOC guy there named Prime, and he told me something that changed my entire life. I think I've been happier, the happiest I've been since I've got out in the past 2 months coming back from this retreat. He told me, he said, a lot of times we do things that are familiar to us when you get out. You think, okay, I was in the military, I'm going to put another uniform on and be a cop, firefighter, something like that. Well, we were there and we did equine therapy with horses and we did some other stuff. And coming from New York City, I did not even know what a horse looked like. So we were petting these horses and doing all this stuff. And I'm like, wow, this is really fun. This is really relaxing. We were riding a horse. And, you know, his big thing was sometimes you have to do things that are different. Sometimes you got to step out of your comfort zone. What you think you want to do or what you think you have planned for your life, maybe that's not it. Step out. The way I look at it now is that every day there's a million doors in front of me, and I can open up any one of those doors, look inside, step inside. If I don't like it, I can turn around and close the door and not go back in that room and open the one right next door. Sometimes you got to just do something different. The whole time I was trying to be a cop, I was trying to do all this stuff, and I realized maybe that's not for me. Maybe I need to do something different, something else that I have never done before that's going to give me some sort of pleasure in life. And I've been doing that, and I'll tell you right now, I've never... All the therapy, the medication, everything I've done, nothing, the other retreats I've been, nothing has helped me out as much as him saying that to me.
That's awesome. You know, what's interesting is, you know, Chris and I talking to you, you know, and you're only 25 years old, and your wisdom is beyond anybody, any 25-year-old that I've ever talked to. So, you know, you have done an incredible job of getting your shit together and getting your life back on track. I mean, it's not easy to do, and I commend you, and we commend you for it.
Let me tell you about a young man that I met that is the polar opposite in so many ways to who you are. I had a radio show, and I interviewed a young man who was running for one of the state Senate seats here in Florida. Single white male with a good job, college graduate, 21 years old. And I had asked him this question. I have a concealed carry permit. And I said, how should I feel if I go out without my weapon and something happens and someone is injured or loses their life that I could have prevented? How am I supposed to feel about that? And his response was, oh, there's never a time when you should have a weapon. It's not my job to protect myself. That's the job of the police. A 21-year-old young man, college graduate, and he's in the norm, believes it's not his own job to be in charge of his personal
protection.
Yeah. Ryan, well, you know, that is such an opposite to what is true or what you stand for, and God bless you, young man.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you know what that is? I've been to 3 different universities here, and they are breeding grounds for the most ridiculous thoughts I have ever seen in my entire life.
We see evidence of it every day. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've argued with a teacher. I just took a class on social justice, so I think you can imagine how that went. And my teacher was a full-blown communist. And I remember sitting there arguing with her, and every argument she had, I could just shut down in 2 seconds. But it's funny when you say something like that, like, oh, yeah, it's the police's job to, help us out.
Well, and the thing she's teaching
people.
Go look
at the average response time for a police. So when someone's breaking into your house and you don't have a gun and they're coming to kill you and your family, well, you want to wait 15, 20 minutes, especially where we live out here in Florida. Sometimes you got to wait for the sheriff to come out. He might be on the other side of the county.
Sorry.
So, yeah, you wait 20 minutes. And let me know how
well,
that goes.
Not even what your wait time is. You want someone else to risk their life when it's you're not even assuming responsibility for your own
protection. It's madness, man. It's madness. That's just
crazy.
Hey,
I think you said it, though. Assuming responsibility. I think that's the big common issue in our country this day. Assuming responsibility.
That's right.
Nobody's responsible for their actions. You know, everyone pushes responsibility to somebody else. That's the big thing. That's the big problem here. But I think the cool thing about being a veteran and all that is you learn to kind of be self-sufficient. So you're always responsible for your actions. So I think that may be something that's actually helped me out here getting out and why I'm, like I said, light years ahead of my peers, because I actually take responsibility for my
actions.
You bet
it is. Yeah.
And I understand that my actions have consequences, so I need to take the proper actions to get to where I'm at.
Exactly. So what are you going to do? What do you want to do now? What are you doing, and what's your plans for the future?
You know, I don't know. I'm actually 100% disabled. I get paid at 100%, but I'm at 90. My PTSD got really bad. I see a therapist every week, and, you know, I've made a significant comeback, and I'm starting to get back on my feet here. But I just bought a house using a VA home loan, which was surprisingly simple, and I have a German Shepherd. So, you know, right now, I go to school. A lot of it's online for forensic psychology. I graduate actually here in January.
Oh, good thing. Congratulations.
Yeah, with my bachelor's. And then I'm going to USF to get my master's in digital forensics. I think I want to work maybe like computer crimes in either the private sector or the public sector. But, you know, right now, it's great. I have all the money that I need to pay for what I got to pay for. And it's really about finding me. It's a great time. It's about finding me and what I like. It's been a great recovery time. My dog has helped me out so much. I can't tell you.
What's your dog's name?
I mean, Odin.
Odin,
like the German god.
Yeah, the Norse. That's Norse, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a 100-pound German Shepherd, and he loves to go out and do anything. It doesn't matter what we do. And I can just grab the leash, throw him in my truck, and we'll go out and do whatever. My stepdad has a boat here and a dock, and I had never been on a boat before. Believe it or not, even being in the Marines, never been on a boat. We were going out. We've been going fishing, something that I have never done before. That's great. We just caught tuna.
Nice.
Gigantic albacore tuna. And I grab my dog. We go on the boat. So I'm thinking about buying a boat here soon. And if not, we go to the dog park, or I take him out, and I'm meeting some younger people in the area here. You know, I'm really just...
I know you know Kendra Simpkins again. with Mind Spa. Kendra?
Yeah, I love Kendra. I'll tell you what, she's actually my my therapist.
She's a great person.
I can contribute about 99% of the way I feel and the way that I've been, like how great my life has been, to her. She's the one who got me to go on the Brian Bill Foundation. I was pretty bad before I met her. And when I met her, I mean, that's someone who's just changed my life. And her being a veteran herself, and a therapist, and she does, you know, the different kinds of therapies, rapid resolution therapy.
Yeah.
And we just did it on Brian Bill Foundation. There were Green Berets, Marstock guys who had been doing therapy with the VA and other stuff. And we went and did therapy with her and her group of people. And all of the guys said, wow, that changed my life. I've been doing therapy forever, and it hasn't worked, this rapid resolution therapy that they're doing. But yeah, Kendra, yeah, she's great.
We sat down and talked several times. You know, myself personally, cognitive behavioral therapy and cannabidiols, you know, hemp-based therapies with some of my brain injury issues. But, you know, all I can say is thank you for your service. Thank you for being who you are. We're glad that you were able to spend time with us here today on Straight Outta Combat. It's important to tell these stories. And I just say that we're very blessed, and I feel blessed personally to have been able to talk to you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. You know, I am new to this area, kind of, so if there are any other veterans listening, if to get my contact info somehow, I'd love to hang out, meet some more veterans. I really want to start something. I'm not quite sure what I want to do to help veterans out, be it a nonprofit or, you know, get my degree in psychology, so I'm hoping I could one day work with people in that aspect.
How can people
well.
Reach you, Ryan? Let people know, and let people know how they can reach you.
On Facebook, you can get to me. It's just Ryan Matthews. That's it. You can just look that up, and I'm in my uniform, so I don't think you can miss it. There's not too many of us on there. So yeah, you can shoot me a thing on Facebook, and I go on there sometimes. I try not to because it's kind of like people fighting about politics, but check it every now and then. I use the messengers.
God bless you, young man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you. Well, Chris, another dose of audio medicine from Green Zone Hero. And, you know, speechless after most of these anymore, it seems like. And a man, 25 years old, decorated for heroism and action, comes back, and some of the things that he points out, and look what he's doing with his life. I mean, he's beyond his years.
And the sense of responsibility, but if there's a single word to describe what you never heard anywhere in that hour-long interview, is judgment or complaint. He never passed judgment on anyone, nor did he complain about a thing that he's gone through. Not once. It's personal responsibility, and he'll do the best he can. Nowhere did he sound judgmental or victim in any of that.
That's a heck of an observation, you know, and that's one thing that we're starting to see, that many of the people that you and I talk to on Straight Outta Combat, they don't make up excuses.
No, there's no excuse there.
They do their duty. They love their country. They come back. They tell us the stories. And, I mean,
it's inspirational.
It is inspirational. I just texted him. I said, Ryan, inspirational talk. Look forward to meeting you in person. And I just want everybody else to continue to listen to Straight Outta Combat Radio. I'm here with my co-host, Chris Hager, Gold Star Father. Please stay tuned. We are proudly American here. We're unapologetically patriotic. You heard Ryan talk about that. And we're politically incorrect, and we're proud of it. And remember,
freedom is not free. God bless.
God bless, Chris. Thank you. Save us all. Before they burn it down.